2540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Three U.S. Marines have died and five have been hurt in the crash of an American military Osprey aircraft today. It happened off the northern coast of Australia.
We know that 23 people were on board the Osprey when it crashed, but it's still too early to say what went wrong. The crash area is incredibly remote, making it even more difficult for rescue crews to gain access. The injured were conveyed to Royal Darwin Hospital with a variety of injuries. Scott Maiman for CBS News, Canberra, Australia.
The Marines were taking part in a multi-nation military exercise at the time of the crash. Three black people have been shot and killed at a store in Jacksonville, Florida. More from CBS's Wendy Gillette.
Police say a white man filled with hate launched a devastating attack.
Plainly put, this shooting was racially motivated, and he hated black people.
Police say the gunman, who was in his 20s, donned a bulletproof vest and mask in the predominantly black neighborhood before entering the store. They say he was armed with a handgun and an AR-15-style rifle painted with swastikas, and that he killed two black men and a black woman, then took his own life.
Bermuda could get hit by Hurricane Franklin, now less than 600 miles away, says senior hurricane specialist Eric Blake at the National Hurricane Center.
We think it could become a Category 4 hurricane by late Monday, and interest in Bermuda should be paying close attention.
A man who angered Russian President Vladimir Putin 2 months ago when he marched some of his mercenary troops toward Moscow is dead. The BBC's Stephen Rosenberg is in Moscow.
Russia's investigative committee announced that genetic testing of bodies recovered from the crash site had been completed. It said the identities of all 10 victims matched the names on the flight manifest. That list of passengers and crew had included the head of the Wagner mercenary group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, and his right-hand man, Wagner commander Dmitry Utkin.
The private plane Prigozhin was on went down Wednesday outside Moscow. American intelligence believes it was taken out by an explosive on board. Former President Trump's presidential campaign says it has raised $7.1 million since Trump was booked in Georgia on election interference charges and his scowling mugshot was released. On CBS's Face the Nation, Chris Christie was asked about that.
There's almost nothing anymore that he could do that would surprise me in terms of the ongoing grift. Donald Trump promised the country when he ran in 2016 that he would drain the swamp. Really, all he did was rearrange the swamp, rearranged it so that he could make money off of regular voters to pay his own legal fees.
CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Reports on electric vehicle sales are mixed. Mike Moan spoke with analysts who say electric vehicle sales trends are encouraging.
Wisconsin has lagged behind other states in electric vehicle registrations, with data showing it ranks 35th in the nation. But the Wisconsin Policy Forum notes that registrations have increased on average by nearly 52% each year over the past decade. As for reports of high inventories, Chris Hardo of Consumer Reports says the estimates exclude EV-only dealers and that their inventories are well below the industry average. Hardo acknowledges that higher interest rates might eventually put a dent in sales of all vehicles, but he says it hasn't happened yet. Customers are still snatching up cars that were hard to find when the pandemic was crippling supply chains. And he says the public remains intrigued by the EV market.
Our surveys to date have showed a pretty significant chunk of the American car buying public who are interested in buying electric vehicle are curious about buying electric vehicle.
It's just an open question of when a lot of these consumers will take the plunge as more EV models come on board. Hardo's analysis finds that 70% of EV sales this year are from just 9 models, all of which have a starting price under $45,000 when factoring in incentives. That's below the average new vehicle price. He suggests those models can be competitive sales-wise, as opposed to higher-priced luxury EVs. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Wisconsin's manner of funding local government is nearly singular in the country. That cheese stands alone, if you will. It hasn't been working in Milwaukee. It hasn't been working in Rhinelander. It hasn't been working in La Crosse, Green Bay, Madison, Kenosha, Racine. I don't care what you pick. It ain't working.
The Maggie Dawn Show, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Did you know your favorite shows and hosts are active on social media too? Find Civic Media on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook and be part of the conversation happening there. And go to our website, civicmedia.us, to learn more about the Civic Media Network.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome to this, our second hour here on Saturday morning, talking about all sorts of things related to indictments in our nation, state indictments, federal indictments, charges, and pending in state courts, federal courts. Right before the break, after our first hour, we're chatting about this proposed process by which several defendants in the state prosecution, subject to the state indictment in Fulton County, are seeking to have their case removed from the state court to federal court, talking about the trappings of doing that. And in particular, we've got some great questions coming in on text, including one from Kathy in Forest Park, Illinois. And Kathy, appreciate very much your comment. Basically, Kathy's question is what are the benefits of doing this? Why would you go down this road? What are the benefits of going from state to federal court? And Kathy has identified at least one of those. Preface all this by saying this is not unprecedented, but a lot of this has to do with decisions that are going to be made by judges, certainly not by me, but as a result of the advocacy of attorneys for the prosecution, advocacy by attorneys for the defense. Everyone is going to be involved in this process, and in the end, the ultimate answers will come from judges who will tell us what the consequences of all of this may be. However, we know that what happened, we know a lot about what happens in federal court, including state court as well. Some of the things that plainly are a part of the overall consideration is that if you go into federal court, presumably in Georgia there, you may in fact have, some people have commented, a more lenient jury pool that may be more sympathetic to one that would be assembled in Fulton County, which includes Atlanta. And there in Atlanta, about 73% of the voters in the 2020 election voted for President Biden, over 26% for Trump. So there may be some strategic sense that, gee, your jury might be more inclined to vote, again, based upon the evidence presented, to acquit. If indeed you might be more sympathetic to Donald Trump as opposed to Joe Biden, that's a purely strategic thing, not a legal thing. Federal case could also allow several of the defendants, perhaps in that forum, to test the limits of the Georgia RICO statute. Again, understanding, very importantly, that you don't get a brand new federal case. It's the state case that gets transferred into the federal court, as peculiar as that sounds. And you'll have a federal judge basically presiding over this case, if indeed it happens. But again, you might have some opportunity to challenge the RICO statute there and ask questions through motions to dismiss, motions to define what the nature of that is in front of a federal as opposed to a state court judge. And then Kathy has also suggested another matter that may be down the road in terms of strategy and process. And that is, gosh, if you get a conviction in the federal court as opposed to the state court, could a future president pardon anyone who is convicted in that federal forum, admittedly still based upon that state prosecution? And the answer would be, again, presuming that the federal judge would impose a federal sentence serving in her or his capacity as a federal jurist, imposing a federal judgment, a federal finding of guilt, and imposing a sentence, that could be subject to a federal pardon, a reprieve by a future president. Now, we don't know if all that's going to happen. And again, stripping all this back, my own sense is that the judge will push all of this back and will not bring this case into federal court. But these are fascinating civics questions to ask, fascinating law questions to ask, process and procedure questions to ask. And it goes back to my general concept that how tragic it is that we have to have these questions answered and asked, right? Our nation right now is in this posture where we are spending our time and our focus appropriately responding to criminal conduct conducted by people who wanted to undermine our legislative process, our electoral college, and skew the vote, and not only undermine but overthrow the vote. Nonetheless, significant that we're now spending our state time, our federal time, addressing people who do not understand the fundamentals of civics, the fundamentals of what our Constitution contemplates, and the notion that our voting system does envision a winner and, yes, a loser. And you don't try to get around it by engaging in criminal conduct, which is what all of these indictments, both the federal indictment in Washington, D.C., and the state indictment in Georgia, basically allege. Great questions being presented this morning. Let's go to some folks who are on the line as well. Let's begin with John in Milwaukee. John, you've been on the line for a while. Appreciate your being a part of our discussion this morning on Morning Cannolis.
Hi, appreciate your show. The show you and your producer are doing is straight out of the top drawer, as usual. I have a question about a theory that I've heard floated out there that with Trump's Jack Smith charges and now the Georgia charges, that there might be some criticism that there is overcharging or stacking, that the charges against Trump in Georgia are redundant to the ones that are brought against him in Washington, D.C. already. And I was just wondering, how is there anything to that? Would you address that argument?
Sure, John. It's a great question. I think there are two answers to it. Let me give you the civics answer, since we're doing a lot of that, a lot of law school this morning. Great question, John. Appreciate the comment, the inquiry. The narrow but significant answer is there's nothing that prevents a federal court, a federal prosecutor, from prosecuting under a situation based upon acts that are also the subject of a state prosecution. The law is very clear on that. The Supreme Court has said that these are two different jurisdictions. You've got a federal court, and there are federal laws, and you can be prosecuted under those. You can also be prosecuted under the state systems around our country, obviously 50 states and territories, that sort of thing. Nothing legally to prevent that. So there's that issue generally. And there is also a policy you should know inside the Department of Justice called the Pettit or Petit policy, based upon some long-standing tradition, that basically says that in many cases, there will be some deference. We often let the state prosecutors go ahead first to see if whether state interests can be vindicated through a state criminal prosecution. That happens a lot when it comes especially to civil rights cases, and not only involving police officers, but individuals who might violate the civil rights of people. We often defer in the federal system to the state prosecution. Doesn't preclude a contemporaneous prosecution or certainly a subsequent prosecution, but you often make the assessment about whether or not, in the wake, say, for example, of a state prosecution, it makes good resource allocation sense to pursue a federal prosecution. If indeed the defendant or defendants are going to spend some time in prison, if the general interests of the rule of law are vindicated, it may well be that resources are better spent in some other areas. But the narrow answer, again, is nothing to preclude a subsequent or contemporaneous prosecution. Why? Because you've got different jurisdictions. You've got different schemes, if you will. I mean that in a positive sense. Schemes of rule of law in America. Different rules, regulations. The case in Georgia is prosecuted under Georgia law. The case in Washington, D.C. prosecuted under federal law. Again, nothing to preclude that, aside from some policy considerations and strategic considerations. That's number one. The issue that I think, John, you also identify is just the public domain issue. It may well be that America, after all of these cases are going forward, and again, they're going to take years and years to resolve dispositively after appeals are taken in the state court and the federal court, there may be some sense down the road that we've done enough, that if indeed there's a sense of justice among the public,
that there could be some decision-making going on in the federal system, the state system, about whether to continue to prosecute those cases. But those are discretionary decisions, and they're made only after the rules of both the state systems and the federal systems are invoked, after the wheels of justice, if you will, are permitted to go forward. And again, probably more of a public domain kind of discussion of the kind that prompts your very good question, John, about stacking or overcharging. The narrow answer is no overcharging here, nothing to preclude one and the other. And it's only if in your perception as these matters go forward that kind of concern would have an implication for a legal decision here as well. So thank you very much, John, for that important question or comment. Appreciate that very, very much. We've got some other callers and other folks sending us some notes on text, which we appreciate tremendously. Joe from Madison, you're calling in this morning. Glad to hear from you, Joe, about any of these important topics.
I would like to echo the sentiments of your previous caller. Just great information, and I also greatly appreciated the two pieces that you started the hour with, your undiscovered justice. They were very helpful, the information on Minnesota and felons voting and also Germany and their changes in immigration law. Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
My question is as follows. Okay, I'm looking at the situation in Georgia with Fannie Willis, and your reaction as a prosecutor, somebody who has prosecuted cases at the federal level, of course, but state level, I imagine it would be the same thing, that you don't go forward with prosecuting a case because it's so expensive and all, unless you're really, really sure that you're going to win. I mean, you don't want to have holes in it and be overcome. My question in pertaining to this would be then, I got to believe that Fannie Willis just has nearly an airtight case, because not only she would be also have the focus on her of national attention and the political side of all of this. Why did you go forward if you didn't have an airtight case? So I'm curious, and maybe this isn't something you want to do this hour, but another time, as a prosecutor looking at what you see that Fannie Willis has at this point, do you think she has any worries at all about people changing testimony or problems coming up, in part because of that situation in Georgia where people can be so easily identified, the jurors could be identified, they have been identified. I'm interested in your comments on that, and I'll take my answer off air. Thanks very much, Jim. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Joe, great comments, and we're going to take that up right now because, indeed, it's on my syllabus this morning to chat about exactly that kind of thing. It's an important question, not at all to be deferred, and, again, it's going to be the subject plenty of a lot of discussion down the road. I will tell you that any federal prosecutor, virtually all state prosecutors, even though the standard at the time of charging is probable cause, you don't have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt at the time of charging, as a policy matter, internal to the process of the prosecution office, before you decide to seek an indictment, you've got sufficient evidence. You believe that you'll be able to present this case beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury at that level. And so, yes, indeed, to use your language, Joe, Fannie Willis has got compelling not only information and evidence to present this case. She is strong in that belief, and she would not have brought this with respect to the second grand jury absent her commitment to this case. But after the break, I'm going to tell you more about that, Joe, and all the other listeners, because it's such an important notion going forward. How do prosecutors behave? And in particular, what about this question of this very broad indictment and the possibility of witnesses, again, being intimidated? We'll chat about all of that right after this break.
Civic Media isn't just another broadcast company.
We're your neighbors. We bleed green and gold.
And we love nothing more than to help fellow Wisconsinites succeed.
Whether your business wants to advertise to your local community or the entire state, Civic Media can help. Find out more at civicmedia.us.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898, but 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network. You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
Well, you can cry me a river. Cry me a
we are back this morning on Morning Cannolis, and we are in the midst of a terrific discussion with callers, with listeners, posing a number of terrific questions about what could and could not happen with respect to these federal and state indictments involving January 6th and other matters as well. And right before the break, talking with Joe from Madison, who raised these very significant questions about prosecutorial discretion, but also prosecutorial decision-making along the way. And right before the break, commenting that it is a general practice, not prescribed by law, not prescribed by courts, but the prosecutors, before they go public, have a strong commitment to the case. This is not a situation most often, typically not a case where you go ahead and simply charge and see how things play out. You present cases to grand juries, you seek charges when you've got a very strong case. In the federal system, our general internal policy has been that, with some exceptions around the edges, anticipating maybe some development of witnesses and some other evidence coming in, we're ready to go to trial. We're ready to go to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that the charges in the indictment can be proved, even though, once again, at the time the charges are issued, the standard is probable cause for a grand jury. Obviously, before a trial jury, unanimity by that jury, beyond a reasonable doubt. That's our process. Defendants presumed innocent until proven guilty, a judge guilty by a jury of their peers. Even so, the matter, the indictment in Georgia is broad. 161 different instances, if you will, of violations of RICO. Now, under Georgia law, Fannie Willis does not have to establish more than two of those, but she's got them all set forth in this indictment and coming out of the grand jury. And without knowing anything more than you do publicly, and not having reviewed the discovery in this matter, nor will I, nor any of us presumably listening to this broadcast this morning, fairly confident, completely confident, candidly, that Fannie Willis has got information to support each and every one of those specific instances, the 161 instances of RICO violations. She's got broad counts here. She's got all sorts of things alleged against these multiple defendants. And she, as I said earlier, she is ready to go. And whether this is going to happen, that is a trial of 19 defendants in one trial very soon, probably unlikely. She probably appreciates that as well. Nonetheless, a very strong sense that the case itself, sweeping and broad, is a significant case. It is a strong case. And regardless of when she brings this to trial, a strong sense that she will be able to present a sufficient amount of evidence to prove to a jury that she has got the evidence, the support, to prove her case beyond a reasonable doubt. Joe's other related comment, what about intimidation? What about things being done by one of the defendants,
perhaps Donald Trump, maybe other people out there, plainly threats being made against grand jurors in Georgia, against the sheriff, who is a now major part of this as well. A couple of observations about that. Number one, completely antithetical to our system. Those things may in and of themselves be crimes under federal and state law, depending upon the circumstances. We know, for example, that there's one woman in Texas who's already threatened a federal judge. Her name is Tanya Chutkan. She is in federal custody now. She's in the subject to a federal charge for doing that kind of thing. And the response, Joe and others, is when people do that because of the need to support the integrity of the system, incredibly important that they be identified, and if there is a sufficient basis to charge them, that there be a response to that. That's called deterrence, right? You deter the individual from doing that conduct down the road. You stop them, and you also send the message to anybody else out there who might think of doing the same thing. That's general deterrence, which we've talked about at great length in this broadcast. You want to send the message that if you're going to intimidate witnesses, you're going to try to impact the ultimate decision by jurors, by the people who are the triers of fact in this case, you won't get away with it. And you yourself will be sanctioned by the system. And Fannie Willis has got to be responsible for all of that. It is a lot, undeniably. But that's her responsibility. And she will be attentive to this, as will all of her staff. She's not doing this alone, obviously. She's got a team there that we have seen on the news regularly. But she's got a lot to do here. Nonetheless, up to the task. And from my perspective, again, miles and miles away here in Wisconsin, but nonetheless, appreciating what it is like to be presenting to the public an indictment of this breadth and this scope, she is ready to go. And she will be presenting this case, doing all the things she needs to do to protect the legitimacy of those witnesses and of the process generally. We've got another caller. Mark, you've been waiting on the line for a long time. Mark, your comment or question also this morning about any of our topics.
Yeah, because it sounds like the Georgia case is pretty airtight, and this and she's pointed out, and it's brought into highlighted attention that this has been a nationwide conspiracy. I mean, they actually labeled it the Wisconsin plan, because it's not just Georgia, Michigan, and Wisconsin. It's also the state of Arizona and other states actually did this whole fake electors thing. And now with Ron Johnson coming out, I believe it was was it Thursday, that he actually had a roundtable, actually more or less confessed to the Wisconsin fake electors conspiracy. He said, well, that was just political activity. You know, it wasn't really something intentional or anything like this. But my point would be is that from my read of Wisconsin Constitution, I think it's 775, which folds into it federal election law, which requires under the 14th Amendment, Section 2, that the right to vote, if it's interfered with, the right to vote for electors, including the electors, that is denied or abridged in any way, that it's a violation. And now it doesn't say that the results of those have to, you know, it's by implication, the results of those votes are supposed to be respected as well. And it's clear to me that they chose to do this because they were thinking that, well, maybe we can get away with this. I mean, but by the Supreme Court decision on that same day the fake electors met, is that the Supreme Court in Wisconsin already said, nope, Joe Biden won the election.
Almost contemporaneous with the very conduct. Absolutely, Mark. And right after this break, I'm going to comment on your good comments and questions. Stay on the line. And everyone, stay with us for that further discussion. We'll talk more about the fake electors, what it says in the federal indictment. And again, as Mark, you've indicated, the intersection only with our senior senator, but also with state law as well. Stay with us for that discussion.
Say you love me. Well, just to prove that you do, come on and cry me a river. Oh, cry me a river.
Broadcasting to Waukesha at 101.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. A U.S. Osprey military aircraft has crashed in northern Australia during a training exercise. The BBC's Phil Mercer has details.
23 people were on board. Three U.S. Marines have been confirmed to have been killed. At least five others have been flown to the Royal Darwin Hospital.
The sheriff in Jacksonville, Florida, says a white gunman who killed three black people at a Dollar General store yesterday was racially motivated. WJAX-TV's Ben Ryan reports.
Mayor Donna Deegan with a strong message to the black community.
I am so sorry that we have failed you in the ways that we have.
The FBI is pursuing this as a hate crime. Hurricane Franklin is moving at a furious pace toward Bermuda.
Franklin is intensifying. Its maximum winds are up to 90 miles per hour. And we expect it to become a major hurricane by this time tomorrow.
Eric Blake at the National Hurricane Center, CBS News Brief.
Hey, this is Matt from Design Garden. Remember when the internet was new? Back then you had to leave your house to start a business. Companies used to pay programmers bags of cash to get online. Now, small businesses can get online with a Facebook business page, or Squarespace, or Google My Business, or WordPress. But which tools should you use? Can you afford to go down the wrong path? Design Garden uses modern tools to build your website the right way. Find us online at design.garden. Again, that's design.garden.
If you're a motorist of the four-wheel variety, please watch out for those of us in Wisconsin who do their traveling on two wheels. Adjust your mirrors to reduce your blind spots. Allow motorcyclists a full lane width. Use your turn signal when merging or changing lanes. And allow more following distance between you and the motorcycle. Motorists and motorcyclists can work together to achieve zero preventable deaths on Wisconsin roads. Zero in Wisconsin. Together we can save lives. Learn more at zeroinwisconsin.gov.
Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
Hey, this is Lindsay Kindert at 540 WAUK The Shaw. At Civic Media, we love our local communities and want to share your stories. Submit your local event and we'll let our listeners know. Email me, Lindsay Kindert, at info@civicmedia.us. That's info@civicmedia.us.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898, but 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Miss our conversations on air? Join the discussion on our social media channels. Find Civic Media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also find social media for specific shows and hosts on our website. Go to civicmedia.us.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night.
We are back here on Morning Cannoli as we're chatting about a number of different procedural issues, some civics issues related to understanding these indictments pending principally in Georgia, but then also in Washington, D.C. Appreciate tremendously the calls, the questions about all this. Right before the break, talking with Mark about his very good and observant comments about the intersection, if you will, between state law and federal law. We know that that is reflected in major portions, also by virtue of the fact that some of the same conduct is charged in both the state case coming out of Fulton County
And in the federal indictment coming out of the U.S. District Court, the U.S. District Court grand jury in Washington, D.C. as well. Along the way, we know that in the state case, we've got at least three fake electors. Their names are Kathy Latham and David Schaefer, and then also Sean Still. All of them identified by name. They are identified as co-defendants. Kathy Latham, we talked about her earlier in the first hour here this morning on Morning Cannolis, former head of the Republican Party in rural Coffee County, which also looms large in that indictment coming out of Georgia. She is allegedly involved in this effort by pro-Trump forces to copy some sensitive election software in January of 2021. Also, in addition to that, among the 16 fake electors in Georgia who cast their electoral votes for Donald Trump, she's facing 11 different charges, including things like false documents, forgery in the first degree, election fraud. David Schaefer, former state senator there in Georgia, former chair of the Republican Party, portraying himself as the chairperson of the Electoral College of Georgia. He filed 16 fake electoral votes for Donald Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence, facing 8 charges similar to those facing Ms. Latham as well. The third person identified in that indictment in Georgia, Sean Still, Georgia state senator, one of these bogus electors who sought to keep Donald Trump in power after the loss to Joe Biden. He's facing 7 charges, including forgery in the first degree, false statements, impersonating a public officer, criminal attempt to commit filing of false documents. All those things in that particular indictment coming out of Fulton County, plainly premised once again upon state law. But we know as well, based upon the allegations, kind of in the core, if you will, of the federal indictment, which is what Mark was also making reference to, we've got a lot of federal violations here as well. Recall once again that in the federal case, unlike the state case, in the federal case, there is one defendant, at least so far. We've got these 6 unindicted co-conspirators, not named by name in the indictment, but we know who they are. They're Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Sidney Powell, Jeffrey Clark, this former DOJ officer who also attempted in the latter days of the Trump administration to become the attorney general, basically due to the bidding of the president at that time to try to overthrow the results of this election. A major portion of the federal indictment describing his involvement, his criminal conduct in an attempt to accomplish the scheme. Kenneth Chesbro, we've talked about before. And then this Boris Epstein, who is an advisor to all this. Those are the 6 unnamed, but nonetheless unindicted co-conspirators set forth in that federal indictment. And the federal indictment also focuses on false electors. And a major portion, again, right in the middle of the indictment, the plan, this overall plan described in the federal indictment, it says capitalized on ideas presented by co-conspirator number 5. Co-conspirator number 5 is Chesbro. He's the one who wrote what's called this Wisconsin Memorandum. And in that memorandum, November 18th, he advocated that because of the ongoing recount at that time, again, later resolved in favor of Joe Biden, Chesbro wrote this memorandum, and he proposed at that time that they should meet and cast votes on December 14th, the date that the Electoral College Act required that they vote, to preserve at that time, and notice how this changes in terms of its intent, the Wisconsin Memorandum written by Chesbro to preserve the alternative of the defendant's Wisconsin electoral state. And then after that, again, according to the federal indictment, this gets worse. The memorandum evolved over time from arguably a legal strategy, to preserve the defendant's rights to a corrupt plan to subvert the federal government function. And that's what Mark was talking about when it comes to, again, this intersection between state involvement, federal involvement, by stopping Biden's electors, their votes from being counted and certified. So the indictment, again, the federal indictment, goes on to describe this false elector scheme, not naming them by name, not the false electors in Wisconsin or in Michigan or in Georgia or the other states, but identifying the nature of the false elector scheme. December 6th memorandum, this one's called the Fraudulent Elector Memorandum, marked a sharp departure from Kenneth Chesbro's Wisconsin memorandum. Why? Moving from something that maybe could have been arguably legal, but now advocating that the alternative electors originally conceived to preserve rights in Wisconsin instead be used in a number of states as fraudulent electors to prevent Joe Biden from receiving the 270 electoral votes necessary to secure the presidency. The fraudulent elector memorandum, again, describing this broad scheme, not just in Wisconsin, not just in Georgia, not just in Michigan, but throughout the country, suggesting that Donald Trump's electors in six of the purportedly contested states should meet and mimic as best as possible the actions of the legitimate electors, and that on January 6th, the vice president, Mike Pence, should open and count those fraudulent mimicked votes, setting up a fake controversy that would derail the proper certification of Biden as a president-elect. What are those particular states? Here they are: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. That's the core, if you will, of the fake elector allegation. Again, mirroring much of what we're seeing now in Georgia, the specifics as to those three. This overall scheme described, again, with great particularity in Georgia, but also in the federal indictment as well. The memorandum, again, this fraudulent elector memorandum, which is the product of Ken Cheesebro's pen, on how fraudulent electors could mimic these electoral, the legitimate electoral voters there. It noted that in some states, it would be virtually impossible for fraudulent electors to successfully take the steps as the legitimate electors because state law required formal participation in the process by state officials or access to those resources. Again, acknowledging that what you're doing is probably not going to work. It did not, but nonetheless, advancing it nonetheless. And sure enough, the allegations in the federal indictment go on to describe just that. Begins in early December. Again, these two memorandums, conspirators and Donald Trump's campaign took the Wisconsin memorandum, expanded it to any state that Donald Trump was contesting. Even New Mexico, it says, where Donald Trump had lost by more than 10% of the popular vote. The expansion was forecast by emails from Donald Trump's chief of staff that were sent on December 6th, forwarding the Wisconsin memorandum to campaign staff. And again, this is the chief of staff about whom we have spoken earlier. He says this: "We just need to have something coordinating the electors for states." He's sending out this document that plainly advances an attempt to undermine the process. That's the reason why Mark Meadows is in the trouble that he is, not only in the state of Georgia, but presumably also in the federal system as well. And then we get this involvement of the Republican National Committee, also described inside the indictment federally. December 6th, defendant named Donald Trump and John Eastman, again, the author of much of this, the architect of much of this, called the chairwoman of the Republican National Committee. We know her name is Ronna McDaniel, to ensure that this plan was in motion. Okay, we got this underway as of early December. During that call, John Eastman, again, at the encouragement of the principal defendant there, the Donald Trump, told Ronna McDaniel that it was important for the RNC to help keep Donald Trump's to keep the electors gathered together in those targeted states. And he falsely represented to her that those electoral votes could be used only if ongoing litigation in one of those states changed the results of Donald Trump's favor. And after the RNC chairwoman, again, Ronna McDaniel, consulted the campaign and heard that work on gathering electors was underway, she called and reported this information directly to whom? To Donald Trump, who responded approvingly. The attempt, the scheme is underway. The fraud is underway, described again with great particularity. December 7th, Rudy Giuliani received the Wisconsin memorandum and the fraudulent elector memorandum, again, the product of the attorneys and Kenneth Cheesebro in particular. Rudy Giuliani speaks with Boris Epstein regarding attorneys who could assist in this fraudulent plan in those targeted states, including Wisconsin. And the next day, December 8th, Kenneth Cheesebro calls the Arizona attorney on the list of Boris Epstein's list, if you will, people who will be involved in this, and says that we've got to pursue this effort. The indictment goes on again in great detail. To manage the plan in Pennsylvania, for example, on December 12th, again, Rudy Giuliani and Kenneth Cheesebro and Boris Epstein participate in a conference call organized by the Trump campaign with the Trump electors in that state. And when Donald Trump's electors expressed concern about signing significant certificates representing themselves as legitimate electors, again, people looking at this and saying, this can't be real. We're asking, we're being asked to sign something that we're indicating that we're not who we say we are. What happens at that time is Rudy Giuliani falsely assures them that their certificates would be used only if Donald Trump succeeded in litigation. After that, co-conspirator six, that's Boris Epstein, proposed conditional language to that effect for potential inclusion in some of those certificates. Campaign official cautioned not to offer the conditional language to other states because why? Those other states, according to the indictment, are signing what he prepared. If it goes out, we change the language for Pennsylvania, it could snowball. In other words, if we've got conditional language there, we might have to do it in other states, including the state of Wisconsin. And in some instances, to their credit, the proposed false electors in Pennsylvania refused to participate in the plan. And on December 13th, as a part once again of the allegations in the complaint, the indictment in the federal system, co-conspirator number five, Kenneth Cheesebrough and Rudy Giuliani sent an email, an email memorandum that further confirmed their plan. That it was not to use the fraudulent electors only in the circumstances in which the defendant, Donald Trump, the litigation was successful in one of the targeted states. Instead, it becomes very clear, based upon the evidence presented in this indictment, presumably to the grand jury, and that Jack Smith will present to a trial jury whenever this case goes to trial, that the plan was intended to falsely present the fraudulent slates as an alternative to the legitimate states here in Wisconsin and the other states at Congress's certification proceeding. That was the purpose of this scheme. That's what they were intending to do. December 14th, at the direction of Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani, the fraudulent electors convened sham proceedings in seven targeted states to cast fraudulent electors in favor of the defendant, Donald Trump. In some states, in order to satisfy legal requirements set forth for legitimate electors under state law, state officials were enlisted to provide the fraudulent electors access to Capitol buildings so that they could gather and vote there. And we saw that in the media at the time that that was happening. In many cases, however, as co-conspirator number five, Kenneth Cheesebrough, had predicted in his own memorandum, the fraudulent electors were unable to satisfy the legal requirements. Why? Because he knew that this was all fraud. And that's a part of the allegations in this overall indictment, a major piece of the indictment in the federal system premised upon this fundamental notion that the fraudulent electors, pretty much from start to finish, or very shortly after this concept was first hatched, intended to undermine our system. And this movement from an arguably legitimate basis to one that was known to be fraudulent by the defendant, Donald Trump, and yes, all of his co-conspirators, takes place. We also know, looking more into the kinds of things that Mark testified and talked about, that based upon testimony given to the grand jury, that our own senior senator may have been involved in some of this as well, that is the hand delivery of these. And so we see later on when the indictment describes in great detail the events of January 6th, what specifically happened involving our senator, our senior senator, and a member of his staff in an attempt to get those false electoral votes into the well of the Capitol and onto the desk of the vice president and the speaker of the House. When we come back, we'll talk about that particular allegation in this compelling federal indictment right after this break here on Morning Cannolis.
My love, I just want one more moon dance with you.
Hi. Hi, I'm Emily from Weichert Realtors Lake Point in Madison. Home ownership is a big deal, and so is taking the leap into the buying or selling of any property. The Weichert team gets that, and our job is to help you navigate the sales process and provide smooth sailing. You have questions? We have answers. You have worries? We have solutions. Let us open the door to your future home. Weichert Realtors Lake Point, 608-721-8002, 2045 Atwood Avenue. Find more info at weichert-lakepoint.com.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898, but 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Jerry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's summertime in Wisconsin, and whatever the weather, it will impact you and your plans.
Should I water the garden? Will our event be rained out? Count on your local Civic Media radio station for in-depth details and the most up-to-date forecast.
Temperatures are rising into the mid and upper 70s under sunny skies.
It's your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
We are back in this, our final segment here in Morning Cannolis. Thank you for once again listening in, joining me in this good conversation, this important conversation about what is charged in these indictments coming out of Georgia and also in the federal system. I hasten to add once again, as we always do, defendants, all of them presumed innocent until proven guilty, the standard there beyond a reasonable doubt, and that will presumably happen at some point. That is a trial in front of a jury. Required to wrestle with the question about whether or not the government has proven its case. Defendants in America rightly, appropriately have no obligation whatsoever to present any defense whatsoever. Also entitled to a defense, a vigorous and important defense in the presentation of their case. And so all of that is a part of our examination. Right before the break, we're talking about the false electors. They loom large, plainly, in the Georgia complaint, the Georgia indictment. They also are described with great particularity in the so-called talking indictment coming out of Washington, D.C. and the grand jury there, spending some time right before the break chatting about the mechanisms through which these memorandums, the lawyers involved, Cheeseman and Giuliani and John Eastman and this advisor, Boris Epstein, to try to accomplish this in the various states, including right here in the state of Wisconsin. We now have out there in America two states that have not only identified this scheme as being contrary to their law, but also identified false electors by name. And those states, are, of course, are Michigan and also Georgia. And those people are now facing prosecution, will be required to stand before the bar of the court, if you will, in front of a jury, and have the prosecution advance its evidence in those particular events, those particular undertakings as well, supported presumably by the events described in the indictments. As a part of this particular indictment coming out of Washington, D.C., we also have, related to not only the Wisconsin memorandum, the Wisconsin false electors, the way in which Wisconsin itself looms large in this federal indictment. It's also mentioned prominently, of course, in the Georgia indictment, as Mark indicated in his comments of a few moments ago, this description by the grand jury in Georgia of the nationwide effort to undermine the vote
has its locus, its focus, if you will, in Georgia, according to that indictment. But it's all over the states, including the six or seven, including Wisconsin, identified similarly in the federal indictment, too. And so we know about a lot of things that happened based upon the allegations, once again, in the federal grand jury, that Wisconsin was also involved through its senior senator in some of these events as well. On the morning of January 6th, an agent of the president contacts a United States senator. That's Ron Johnson. This, according to paragraph 101 on page 37 of the indictment. We're now talking about things happening on January 6th. We've got events described there, the ellipse, the presentations by Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman. You recall them well, the president himself at that time speaking to the crowd on the ellipse before the insurrection, before the riot, before the death, before the violence, the insurrection at the Capitol happens on that morning. We know, according to the allegations in the indictment, that an agent of Donald Trump's contacts a United States senator, that's Ron Johnson, and asks him to hand deliver documents to the vice president. He plainly has access by virtue of the fact that he is a United States senator. That agent then facilitated the receipt by a member of the senator's staff of the fraudulent certificates signed by Donald Trump's fraudulent electors in Michigan and Wisconsin. Once again, Wisconsin looming large in this process. And again, those certificates signed by Donald Trump's fraudulent electors in Michigan, Wisconsin, which were believed not to have been delivered to the vice president or the archivist by mail. In other words, we need to get those to the vice president into the well of the House of Representatives where they're counting these votes, that effort being made on the morning of January 6th, according to the allegations in this indictment. Goes on to say, when one of the senator's staffers contacted a staffer for the vice president, that's Mike Pence, by text message to arrange for delivery of what the senator's staffer had been told were an alternate slate or slates of electors for Michigan and Wisconsin because the archivist didn't receive them, the vice president's staffers rejected them. They said no. And again, we saw a lot of that in the media at the time of these events being addressed and being revealed by members of our media. We saw a lot of that. And we know as a result of the consequences of that particular event that those electoral votes, those fraudulent votes from Wisconsin and Michigan and other states did not in the end affect the vote. Did the insurrection, the riot, suspend the counting? Absolutely. Absolutely. For hours on end, while some sense of calm and peace had to be restored, as a result of Mike Pence and a result of the commitment by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, and the leadership, candidly, there as well, a commitment not to give in. They returned late at night and said, we're going to continue with this process. We are going to count the legitimate votes, not the false votes. We don't know if they knew about the scheme at the time, but not the false votes, not the false electors. We're going to count. We're going to open the envelopes, and we're going to pursue this in a way that's legitimate under the Constitution, and they did that. So all these efforts, including this effort involving our senior senator, set forth in the allegations in this complaint, an attempt to try to undermine the process, in the end, none of it worked. None of it worked, as we well know in history, does not mean, of course, that the crimes were not committed. And again, according to the allegations in the complaint against Donald Trump, what are those crimes? It's conspiracy to defraud the United States of America. Various methods that Donald Trump and his co-conspirators, the six of them, and certainly others as well, tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election. All these related efforts to obstruct the vote certification proceedings, including what we just recited here, involving trying to get our senior senator to get those false electoral votes onto the floor for counting. Two charges there of vote certification proceedings violations, one of obstructing that process and one of conspiracy to do so. And then this other charge, again, premised upon all of this, a conspiracy to violate civil rights, an attempt to reverse the election results in states with close elections. We know what those states are. They include the state of Wisconsin. And so all of that, again, set forth in this omnibus indictment, not as broad, not as sweeping as the one in Georgia, which leads me to a final question coming in from a good listener here from Mary from Mount Horeb, who asks about the extent to which, again, between the federal and the state system. She says, can Merrick Garland Can Merrick Garland be involved in this in any way? If indeed some of these attempts right now by Georgia election officials, by Georgia legislators, if they try to replace Fani Willis, to suspend her, to take her out, can Merrick Garland do something about that? The narrow answer is no, but that kind of a process, plainly illegal, plainly under state law, federal law, should be the subject of review by a state court, by a federal court, challenging anybody who would try to do that. We have spent a lot of time this morning. We'll continue this with our next broadcast, talking about the nuts and bolts, both of the state prosecution in Georgia, and also significantly, this federal prosecution. We're going to hear more about it on Monday. From a district court judge in the District of Columbia and the state court judge, federal judge, in Georgia, telling us more about what happens down the road. Stay with us for those future discussions right here on Morning Cannolis. Have a good week, everybody. I've been trying to pursue.
Larry, it's your mom. Did you know the Civic Media Network covers the whole state of Wisconsin? They can help your business get the word out, whether you want to reach a smidge of folks or just want the whole kit and caboodle. Call 608-819-8255. Okay then, bye.
For over a century, AM radio has evolved to meet the needs of our community. More than 80 million listeners depend on AM radio each month. It's also the backbone of the emergency alert system, keeping us safe in dangerous times. A new bill in Congress would ensure this free, reliable service remains in cars. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM radio for every vehicle act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Join the conversation with your favorite hosts or shows anytime. Follow Civic Media on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Share your thoughts on our social media channels wherever you are, whenever you want.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.